Radio Decidim. In autumn 2019, we celebrated the first edition of Decidim Fest, the global meeting of Decidim. It was an invitation to think about the relations between technology and the challenges of democracy in the networked society.
We believe digital services like Decidim are a new type of public infrastructure that municipalities and other public organizations should learn to build and maintain together collaboratively. As more and more policies are implemented as software, we need to ensure that the code used by public administrations is open, accountable, transparent, and under the control of the governments that implement them. The Foundation for Public Code is helping cities come together around core applications and build the tools and platforms they need for the future using modern development practices and processes. Listen to the following keynote, Collaborative Code is the Future of Cities, from Ben Cerveny, President of the Foundation for Public Code.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for inviting me here to talk about this. It's been very inspiring and thought-provoking morning. I'd say primarily inspiring because I understand a lot more Spanish than I expected to, so that allowed it to be thought-provoking. And the thought-provokingness was really in sort of recognizing that this community is very much close to our hearts here at the Foundation for Public Code. We're working towards, I think, very similar goals, as you'll see in my presentation. Let me see if I can do this magical advancing. There we go. I'm going to start with sort of a little philosophical zooming out. Just to sort of set the stage for where we're all going, you know, in some of the tools that we're building with Decidim and other tools, sort of the core thing to recognize is that a lot of what we're talking about are processes, and they're processes that have been underway for a very long time. The city is something that is perhaps the longest continuously running process that humans have ever generated. And so, sort of fitting into the flow of how this unfolds is kind of a massive undertaking. It's a real kind of sea change that one has to imagine if you're going to introduce new kind of tools into a process that's been moving for this long. On the flip side, you know, we sort of have this, what, you know, people in Silicon Valley love to call the great disruption, all this tool generation that's been happening in the last 20 years of, you know, mobile phones and network technologies and sort of all of these kind of, you know, things coming at us faster and faster that we're sort of not quite sure how to handle, and it's caused, you know, huge transformations in, you know, social equity and all sorts of facets of society. And, you know, we're kind of facing a challenge on how do we account for, you know, the arrival of, you know, 10,000 bikes into our city all of a sudden, or a technology that allows only certain people to use transit systems, or, you know, displace people out of their homes from by short-term rental. So I think really the real question is, you know, software might be becoming infrastructure. And this is sort of pivotal moment in the way that society operates, or the way that humans have always operated, right? Humans invent things all the time. And for about the first 30 years or so that those things exist, we call them technology. And then if they work, we call them infrastructure. And this change between technology and infrastructure is a huge shift, because what it sort of suggests is that the way in which we relate to these capabilities is becoming a right. It's becoming something that we expect. And if that's the case, then there are totally different actors involved in the sort of provision of these rights. Interestingly enough, cities have always been the crucible where this transformation happens. You know, you think about all the things that we take for granted now. I mean, this is one of the things that I find so amazing when people come and say, like, oh my God, I can't believe how much control Google and Facebook have over my life. Because you can say, like, do you live in a city? Because if you do, you have no idea where your food comes from, where your water comes from, where your electricity comes from. We have managed to sort of metabolize our relationship with these things that we used to call technologies and now just call infrastructure, and don't ever think about. You never think about it. It just happens, you know. But somehow, because these network services are new, they're in our face. They're a change that we recognize. But cities have a technique for sort of understanding how this works, and that's that they use code of their own. to match the sort of code that's inbound, right? They use policy to metabolize technological change. So, you know, cities are a crucible for understanding how changing technologies, can be metabolized and turned into infrastructure, essentially. And this has been, you know, in some ways, what the city is a machine to do. It has provided, over the centuries, layers and layers of optimization in how people can live well together. And this, you know, latest wave of technologies is just the newest thing. So, you know, the way that the code, civic code, works is that it is a, you know, it defines a possibility space for the operation of society. So you have, you know, a rule set, essentially, which is very much similar to a code base, but that code base is, you know, allowing people to live together successfully in a lot of different ways. So a lot of things have been sort of turned into, you know, sort of metabolized, the technology moving into infrastructure by the city over time. And all, you know, this is, again, these are all things that we now sort of don't even think about how complicated of an operation it is to provide these services to huge amounts of people every day. They're just happening in the background. Sure, that's just what a city is. But somehow software is now in this moment where it's moving through this sort of veil of being something that we see as an object that's out in front of us to something that's just in, that we're soaking in, you know, like the rest of sort of urban systems that we partake in. So there are a couple of problems about this moment, though, in the relationship between software and policy, one of which is that, you know, policymakers at the moment have very little grasp of what they're dealing with. And this is partially because the city has a, you know, in some ways that policy and software have very different refresh rates. Policy, you know, software is moving incredibly fast. The transformations, this is why it's called disruption. And policy has an incredibly, you know, long consensus building process because it's going to include everyone and it's a decision for the long term. So there's definitely, you know, a differential in the way that software changes versus the way that policy changes. And meanwhile, taking advantage of this, the software industry has moved in and said, oh, we're actually going to capture all this value that should be, you know, part of the public domain. And so the idea that, you know, all of these services that we sort of start to think about as, you know, I think many people already approach things like Facebook and Google as public services, but they don't realize that they are engaged in a huge economic activity, which is the value extraction around their data. And so this, you know, this sort of moment that we're in at right now is sort of in this crazy imbalance. And, you know, the idea is that, potentially what we really want to be able to see is an innovation cycle, which is about disruption on the top side of the arrow and then integration on the lower side of the arrow. This is what policy should be able to do. The software can disrupt and make huge amounts of changes, and then as it becomes infrastructure, it's integrated back into society in a way that it benefits everyone. So, you know, this is kind of the moment that we begin from, is like, how do we actually actualize this? So, you know, there are a lot of problems that we see in the current situation. There's obviously, you know, proprietary code bases, I think, being a thing that we all recognize here. And this is not a thing I need to tell you guys, because I think we're all working toward this together. But, you know, there are a lot of people in the political context that just don't understand what's at stake here. They don't realize what they have sold out by, you know, giving away the data in these, you know, relationships that they have sometimes, and by creating these long-term sort of licensing deals where they're implementing, you know, these services that are external to their own agency. So they're actually giving up their ability to make choices. So, you know, again, Barcelona, I think, would be considered the home base of the narrative of talking about technological sovereignty at this point. And I think that's, that's really the lowest level of what we're saying, is that software and is converging with policy. You know, a lot of what, you know, software in the public sector is an implementation of policy. And a policy has an enormously, you know, evolved process of choice making that's consensual, that has a deliberative phase that is transparent to the people involved and the people who it affects. And software right now doesn't have that guarantee. And so one of the things that we need to definitely work toward is providing this kind of, you know, guarantee for the cities themselves, much less the citizens in the cities, but also for the people that are making choices in the political sector. They're not allowed allowed to sort of have their own agency in their relationship with the code bases, with the providers at this point. People that are providing cloud service-based tools often can say something is out of scope if they don't, if it's not on their agenda to fix an issue. But unfortunately, you know, for a democracy, if they have a vote on something that's implemented in software and say like, oh, hey, we want to change our parking services so it doesn't, you know, no one's going to have to pay on Saturday, and they go to their service provider and the service provider says, oh, that change is out of scope. Well, it turns out you can't have out of scope in a democratic result. I mean, that's like kind of what democracy is about. So this is really, you know, evident in the fact that it needs, you know, a lot of the software that we're using in these, the proprietary software often is something that is provided by a culture that is far away from where it's implemented. And so, you know, sometimes you see in these, you know, in the way that decisions are made, software in a way has terroir, which I think I'm getting ahead of myself. Terroir being a French word about the provenance of a wine, where it comes from and how it gets a certain flavor coming from the soil that it's grown in. Software also has a terroir. And this is something that is really, I think, has not really dawned on the people that participate in it, both as a in a commercial context like in Facebook, but also as a, you know, a B2G or whatever kind of service provider that you've subscribed to, where you've brought in a piece of software to help citizens or to help a community. This type of, you know, localization is not evident. There's no sense that the choices that the local community has made have been encapsulated in the software. Software itself is an encoded series of choices that are often culturally situated. And if you don't sort of recognize that, then you just sort of slam cultural decisions that come from an external context into a society and cause some kind of, you know, sort of almost tool dysmorphia. The tools themselves don't fit the society that are using them. And so the idea that one would have, you know, open and public code bases that one could fork and change and make one's own, you know, adapt to local circumstances is something that's, you know, we have to sort of begin to understand how that's necessary. So, you know, much Barcelona, Amsterdam, some of the other cities that we at the Foundation for Public Code are talking about, and many others, are already starting to think about how to take on some of these challenges, and that, you know, starts with code bases like DCDM. It starts with the capability of a city to understand its own agency in the generation of the software that runs it. The idea that, you know, in the same stack, public code, as we consider it, is a stack that's built out of both policy and software that implements that policy. So it's a full, you know, sort of extension of the policy into the implementation layer. And so you have to then, if you sort of recognize this connection, then you have to make sure that the software is always, you know, every time you make a change to it or you develop it in continuous integration, you have to make sure that you're still staying inside the bounds of the policy that describes the function of the software. So this is what allows software to be governable, to be transparent, to be deliberative. It allows, you know, the political class and the people in general to have a handle on what's going on in the digital infrastructure that is behind the scenes that they're living inside of. So, you know, public digital infrastructure it will account for an enormous amount of activities in everyday life. And the question is, you know, where, you know, there's going to be a huge ecology of providers. And of course, there are always going to be the private providers of this technology. And those private providers will probably be spending some enormous amount of money on advancing, you know, the functionality. And so we'll have like whiz bang, you know, products that are doing things that the sort of the public utilities are not, but the public utilities will be there for the people that don't have access to those other services. And these are all things that are super important to recognize that, again, we do now consider often as rights, and therefore, you know, if there are going to be software services that provision this, that those services need to be made available broadly. So this is what I was saying before, is that public code for us is sort of more than open source, because open source, sort of one of the things I find a little bit troubling about open source is it doesn't have any, there is no sort of understanding of what it might be used for. You know, it's certainly it's open and it's available for everyone, but you know, you could make an open source product that catalogs children of immigrants to be separated from their parents, for instance, and that's not something that public code is would be qualified to do necessarily. So the idea that, you know, you have a policy stack that lives on top of the code and those things evolve together is very empowering. And also the code itself, sort of the processes that generate the code have been so powerful in marshaling. This is one of the things we haven't really made clear in the kind of technological revolution the internet revolution we've just gone through. In the industrial revolution, it was very obvious to see, you could point at a car production line and say, like, you know, it started with a car a day and now it's like 4,000 cars a day or whatever. But the thing that we haven't really sort of figured out yet is that basically version control, GitHub, this idea that people can be working massively simultaneously on a code base is a thing that has changed the way that software is produced forever. But the thing that's interesting about that is that software is, you know, basically text. And it turns out policy is also basically text. So if we can build the, you know, institutions and framework to allow policy to evolve in some governed and collaborative and transparent and deliberative way, in the same way that we have marshaled sort of the manpower around software, then we can evolve a dynamically adaptive governance process, which is responsive to the types of disruptions that the rest of technology offers, which is, of course, I think where DCDEM is already headed, is into this space of having a collaborative, you know, very high iterative rate of being able to make these decisions. I think I've talked about most of that stuff. So the part of the, you know, where we end up as we are in this first phase of this process is we do have products like DCDEM that have emerged from municipalities that have understood the value of having this type of infrastructure. But what we don't have is this kind of bridging of how all of these issues are arising in cities simultaneously. And, you know, software providers have actually taken advantage of this because they sell, you know, the same product to all these cities, you know, each one with a separate licensing fee. But this is where this sort of differentiation that open source provide really comes into play, which is that if you're building open source software alone, this is not as cost effective as using a commercial product, because you have not diffused the risk or the cost of development with a community of practice. So the only way in which public administrations can, you know, effectively offer up the idea of developing open source software to their financial departments and to the people that, you know, evaluate what the choices might be in procurement, is if they can say, we're going to go into this problem space with 5 other municipalities or 8 national governments or some body of actors that will all be able to collaborate and pool resources into solving these problems. And so this is where the Foundation for Public Code comes in, is to try and build this framework for this type of collaboration across public organizations. So in doing this, we sort of have evolved a process. Well, I should say we're sort of shaping a process, and we're, you know, iteratively shaping this and are hoping for your input in the shaping process, because we are just understanding it ourselves. And of course, our process itself, and much in a meta-DCDEM way, is, you know, available to all of the members of our association to, you know, help understand. But we've sort of articulated the idea of code-based stewardship as a service to public institutions. So we have, in sort of the first step of trying to understand this, we have also, open for public comment and request for comment, generated a set of what we call standard for public code, which is a set of criteria that we evaluate software code bases by, well, I should say policy and software code bases linked together by, as things that we could consider public code and sort of put our little seal of approval on it. And in this instance of evaluating things as public code, we're looking for things like, is it well documented? Is it approachable as a code base? Does it have an active community? Does it have, you know, builds that can be forked and deployed in different contexts, you know, and these are, again, not criteria that we have set in stone. In fact, they're evolving based on our membership. But what we do want to make sure is that we are going to, you know, evaluate code bases in this way, and then ultimately those that pass the standardization process can be, you know, there'll be a huge set of these possible things for us to steward as a foundation. So the idea is that, you know, step one is to offer up this standard as a way to bring code bases toward collaboration, even if we're not the active stewards of it. If you comply with this standard, your code base will be way more approachable by a larger community. It'll be easily communicated, you know, among a set of users, and will be ready to be, you know, sort of part of an active community and code base stewardship. So we have four segments of code base stewardship, four practices, activities, pardon me. those activities kind of deal with a lot of the different facets of what it takes to make an active and successfully reuse code base. And I think one of the things that's really great in coming here is that we can see all of these things in play already. You know, DCDM is a very successful example of something that's already headed almost entirely in this direction. I mean, we probably have some gap of what we've officially said are the criteria that DCDM doesn't exhibit yet, but almost everything is there. So, you know, community development in a way I think is probably the most important, because this is another thing that a lot of people in policy don't understand about software, especially open source software, and even a lot of commercial software developers don't understand about open source software development, is that open source software is people. Like, you can have a code base that, you know, this happens a lot, unfortunately, with some of the code bases that have been worked on for a long time in the public sector, especially in things like, you know, some Horizon 2020 grants. A lot of times will have been, you know, 35 million euros and 15 cities and et cetera, et cetera. And then the thing launches and the grant runs out and everyone goes home and everyone's like, what is this? Like, where is everyone? And so community is really about making sure that there is, you know, that there is an approach. You know, there's a way for people to get involved, that it's like, that it is facing them, you know, sort of in a way that's accessible, and that it's documented and understood in a way that people can look at. And then most importantly, I think, again, for DCDM, for a totally different reason, is that you need to evolve a model for governance of the code base. Because one of the things that also happens in public administrations is the inability to let go. A lot of cities build things for themselves, and they realize that it would be really useful to have other cities collaborating with them in making something. Turns out, however, they're not willing to let those cities have any say in what the software is going to do in the future. So they're just like, well, why doesn't everyone else come on board? We'll just continue to drive ahead and everyone else can just, you know, come along with us. And it's like, well, what if they have different needs? you're kind of replicating this process that you're trying to get out from under in Silicon Valley. So, you know, you instead need to find a way to build a collaborative community of governance. And it turns out that there might be a code base that does that pretty well already. So DCDM is something that would be really interesting to think about as a way. I mean, Meta DCDM already does this for itself, but I mean, as a way to do with many other code bases, is something that sits on top of GitHub or whatever, GitLab or other version control system that you're managing. You have sort of a political process that exists in kind of a discursive space, a collaborative space, or sorry, a deliberative space, and then those things can become issues that enter into the beginning of the pipeline of the actual development process. So it's sort of this a bridging between the political cycle and the technological cycle. probably another thing that is greatly successful here with DCDM, but also a thing that's sorely lacking on many publicly developed software projects, is the idea that there needs to be communication about it outside of the organization. A lot of you know, technological solutions in cities or national governments or in a lot of these environments, even if they're open source, they don't actually think about anyone except for their constituents. So they're just heads down and they're making this thing. And like four cities away is someone who has exactly the same problem. And they are just starting in on a project. So if the first city had just said like, hey, we have this thing, it does X, Y, and Z, it's really easy to use, you know, here's some screenshots, here's a little how-to on how to make it happen. The city B would not have gone off on their own, but instead would have merged their man hours into the development of the same project with city A. But it's really, that is not in the remit of cities. Cities do not think about their peers. So interestingly, in this kind of facet, we have found in the work that we've done, we've been talking to a lot of cities and other entities, and we found actually that states are much more sensitive to this issue. They understand that cities need to talk to each other. Cities don't. States are like, wow, it would be really great if you could get our two major cities to talk to each other. The quality assurance part of it is actually kind of the underlying you know, kind of foundation of the foundation, as it were. It's the thing that allows these code bases to succeed. I mean, you need to be able to say that this is legible code. I mean, it's not just about the function of the code. We're trying to be relatively agnostic. We don't have like a stack politics that we're going out and saying only use, you know, Angular or whatever. But we do have a set of, you know, as detailed in the standard, we have a set of criteria about coding styles, just in terms of legibility and documentation, that allows people to pick up the code and move into it. So we're actually going to be involved going forward. Right now, we're taking a lot of code bases that already exist and sort of auditing them to see if they work with the standard, and then probably taking some of those into stewardship. But going forward, the idea is that we're going to continue to be part of a continuous integration process that is, you know, a collaboration between municipalities, and then can sort of be there as the moderators of how the pull requests work, you know, to provide kind of the functional back end for working in continuous integration. Like, we can be the people that like deal with the pull requests and deal with the kind of moderation around that. And then probably most interestingly, and a little bit the trickiest part in some ways, is the support angle of things, in the sense that what support means in this sense is that most municipalities don't actually have internal code development capabilities. They have some. They may have like an architectural group and probably some people that do little tasks, but a lot of times the actual core development of big projects is done by external contractors. And so the idea of creating an ecosystem of those contractors that have literacy in what being, you know, certified in public code is, what some of the big projects are that public code is maintaining. So much like the Apache Foundation or the Mozilla Foundation, these things are, you know, sets of products that are open, that commercial agencies can create relationships with municipalities or other public administrations to extend or to implement specific versions of, or to work with in some way. And so this creates a new type of industrial capacity that could also be quite a bit more localized to the municipality, rather than going to a cloud provider that's in a different continent. They can work with a local agency that has literacy in an open product to achieve the results that they need. And then that agency can understand the value of returning those changes to the core application, because that means they will be recognized as experts in this domain and possibly called on by other municipalities that are doing the implementation. So we're, you know, it's sort of in this, the on-ramp of this process. We've talked to a lot of different public administrations on different levels. Like I said, with the states seem to really be interested in, there's another really interesting kind of relationship that we've identified, which is with a lot of times on the national scale, there will be, I think here in Catalonia, there's I forgot what it's called, Red Catalonia or something, is a network of municipalities that are already doing this kind of infrastructural IT collaboration. And so a lot of times the foundation actually can sort of build on these efforts that have happened on a national scale and take that to an international scale, where there are a lot of times municipalities of certain types across different, you know, national borders or international borders that share a lot of the same issues. And so you can sort of find the municipalities that you're working most like and find a community of practice kind of laterally, you know, between those entities. So, you know, we've been really amazed by the response, because a lot of times, you know, this is one of these things where it's an emergent issue. We're just at that moment in cities' understanding of their role in software architecture, their role, their responsibility providing some of these technical services or this network services to their citizens. And so a lot of times when we show up to these entities, they say, oh yeah, we were just talking about and the need for an entity like what you're talking about. So it's an interesting moment and a really exciting one. So in terms of the code bases that we're looking at, we're, you know, right now, like I said, at the beginning, we're going to be looking more at code bases that already exist and seeing how far, sort of what the gap is to refactoring them to something that would comply with the standard that we could actually steward. In the future, of course, we're going to hopefully be involved at the beginning of a lot of collaborative projects with cities so that we can actually be with them through the whole process. But we've already started to look at a number of code bases. We're going to take several into stewardship. The way our association works is that it's entirely owned by members, and the members are all public organizations. And so in some ways, we kind of function as kind of an external development process consultative group, or you know, sort of a group around which this these types of collaborations can form, that each city already has kind of a relationship with, that that makes this almost like an external part of their own technology development process. So one of the things that's been really interesting about this kind of, you know, moving through all of these contexts and talking to all these, you know, stakeholders in cities is, first of all, where they sit in the municipalities and states is so different from municipality to municipality. It's almost like one of the things I was saying is the first piece of public code we should commission is some kind of visualization of how different all of these, you know, it's like a zoology of like different municipal functions and the way that they have metabolized the internet and IT technology, because, you know, it sort of arrived in, you know, at a certain moment in the evolution of the city, and there were different, you know, forces that like situated it sometimes in the, you know, in the transportation department, sometimes in the, you know, there's a little consultative division inside of a city that's been formed called the Data Lab. This is in Amsterdam. There's like an agency kind of that's moving through other parts of the city, helping them do their work. Here, obviously, there's a wholly owned subsidiary of Barcelona called IMI, which is like a separate from the government, but also, you know, fully owned by it and operating in its shadow. But it's just the way all of these forms are very different. So, but the thing that's interesting about that, and they also have a very different culture of how they relate to technology. I mean, it's been, you know, interesting to see over the last 10 years, this kind of, there's an acronym that I used to hear in Europe all the time that immediately made me think, these people don't get it yet, which is ICT. ICT is an acronym that makes it sound like, that's where the Ethernet cables come from, right? That's the office down the hall from the janitorial services. And this was a perspective that was even sort of kept up as these people were slowly being owned by the various different network service providers that they were subscribing to. So it was a strange cognitive dissonance that you'd find by this kind of, you know, they figured if they had the language to like successfully capture and encapsulate, you know, technology in this little, you know, acronym and division, that they wouldn't be affected by it, but instead it was just like washing over them. But then the thing, despite all those differences, you know, the needs are so similar. Like, you know, as we said, the part of it is because so many of these services have been brought by private industry, and then, you know, the screws have been turned. Whether it's, you know, a lot of states have systems that are at the core of their function, like the idea of, you know, how do you manage the voting process in your municipal city council? Some cities have the situation that's very much like LexisNexis in the U.S., where you have this like privatized application that's capturing all the data from your municipal government, and then you're given an API that you can like micro pay to get the data back about what you voted on in your own city, which is just like mind explode. So this like situation is one where, you know, these things are necessary. This thing that I spoke of, that's sort of like the GitHub for policy and public code, is a huge undertaking that some public administrations will have to collaborate on. But there are all these, you know, there's definitely this sort of public option version of many things that people talk about all the time. You know, certainly the Airbnbs and the Ubers that usually get mentioned. But there are also lots of other things, you know, the library systems and museum operation, K-12 school operation, all of these things have software infrastructure behind them, and there could be very large collaborative projects that help people govern those things together. So the foundation is, you know, this organization. It's made up of its members, which are all public administrations, and it's a set of tools and processes that bring these institutions together to make software as public infrastructure. I have four other colleagues here with me. I don't know if you guys want to stand up. These are my teammates. I don't know where Klaus is. Oh, there he is in the back. Okay, yeah. So these guys are also here. We're learning as much as we can from DCDEM's success in this way so far, and wanting to talk to you guys about, you know, how you're situated in this kind of process, and how you feel about what we're doing and what we could change and do better. And we're also hiring, so there is that. So check that out and see what you think about that kind of thing. And thanks very much. I'll take some questions.
Okay, first question here.
Hi, thanks for your talk. I am interested in if this standard for public code you have has a chapter of artificial intelligence, or are you studying about it?
We haven't explicitly got there yet, but I think that, you know, some of the broader kind of criteria that we have about explainability and transparency, this idea is something that that is, you know, at the lowest level of thinking about artificial intelligence and the kind of algorithmic decision making. And it's not an easy question to answer, right? Because a lot of algorithms, especially, you know, machine learning is you can't, I mean, even the architects of the algorithm don't know what it's doing after there's like, go to it. And then you ask them later, like, why did it decide that? And everyone's like, So the question is, you know, governability is something that we're definitely aiming for in public code. And the question is, how do you make artificial intelligence that is governable? And these are tough questions we don't have the answers to yet. So I don't know if we can really have criteria that, you know, that decide, but we can have criteria that helps point in the direction, you know, there's much to learn, I think, is the question about that.
Any more questions?
Okay, hi. I'm from Taiwan, and I want to know more about the governance structure and you say the stewardship, because like now in urban space, if you want to build a park or build a road, there's a procedure that the government should make the neighborhood to come. So when it turns into like a cold space as online digital space, how can this process be possible, make government accountable, and people, how do we build a digital literacy that they can monitor the government?
These are excellent questions, and I don't think we know the answers to them yet. We're just starting in this process, but I think, you know, we definitely believe that each of these code bases will probably have their own governance body. That's a technical steering committee and probably a kind of social or political steering committee as well. And then, of course, our foundation itself will have this type of steering body. And we're evolving that, you know, we have a voting model that is going to be tied to, you know, how much you're going to be able to contribute from your municipality, but we also are going to be able to level that out in some way. It's going to be an iterative process for sure, but per code base, I think, you know, the idea of implementing something like DCDIM, which allows for people to have this active participation is definitely our hope. But I mean, I think GovZero has done like obviously an amazing job of sort of like, you know, providing this kind of infrastructure. She's like, no, but providing amazing infrastructure that was kind of a hack at first, but then, you know, made it into government. And I think it's, you know, these are the sorts of things where it's like an iterative process, right? We're trying to build a set of tools that allow us to evolve those tools as we go to sort of understand how that will work in the future.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Matt.
I'm Matt. I admire what Foundation for Public Code is doing, and I admire your optimistic view that policy is made in transparent ways with the consent of the people it covers. Mm-hmm. You talked a bit about how technology should change to more align with, you know, age-old policy processes. Are there ways in which policies should change? For example, you brought up a great example of, you know, policy is often a moment in time whereas technology continues to evolve in the code. Have you seen mechanisms where policy can do a better job keeping up with technology?
Well, I mean, we're just now entering that phase where the public sector is recognizing these mechanisms they can use to do that sort of thing. But I don't, you know, I think there's definitely, you know, policy is obviously not always the right thing to be projecting back on technology. I mean, policy can be, you know, this is a question concerning technology of any kind, right? Is like, who is it wielded by and on, you know, for what reason? But the point here is that if you make explicit these connections, that you know, if you're implementing a code base that then has to be represented as policy, and in a way that is not something we're explicitly talking to cities about, something that they'll be transformed by participation in this process. But if they are doing that, then they have made their policy explicit as well as their technology. You know, so if there is a tool chain and a set of processes and tooling that allows them to, you know, produce this, then that implicitly also means that they have, you know, made as explainable as the code base their policy that's connected to it. So, you know, and the road there is, you know, I'm sure swerving and rocky, and we'll have lots of, you know, fits and starts. But I think, you know, it's definitely a way to use this kind of idea of, you know, iterative, collaborative kind of a deliberation, you know, to aim that back a little bit at policy, even as, you know, it's sort of a, you know, bring, hey, let's bring policy into the software. And it's like, well, also let's, you know, bring this kind of transparency of open source back into the policy is the hope, at least. And I mean, as far as examples, again, you know, this is DCDM is a pretty good example so far, but I think there are a lot of examples where, you know, these a lot of times very little, you know, interventions have worked out, but definitely there are systems like the library system so one of our closest collaborators right now and a really great example of all of this work is an organization called OS2, somewhat strangely, but it's a collective of Danish cities that are all working together on building software, and they have a very informal relationship where they work together on building all these things, and they have developed like 5 or 6 different tool sets, but you know, some of them are core things that they use to do. For instance, probably the most interesting one that sits almost at the crux, in the same way that DCDM becomes meta in talking about this process, they've built a thing called Kitos, which is a way of cataloging your technical, mostly software infrastructure as a municipality and tracking when your contracts will be up and how much you're paying. And then you can decide to share that with people in the community of cities, you know, within this OS2 group. They then can go, once they know that information, they can collectively bargain with their service provider and get better prices as a collective, or they can say, you know what, it would cost us all together 35 million euros to relicense this thing for another 5 years, why don't we just spend that on developing software together? And so that's, you know, both allowing them to create a better kind of political situation for themselves because they're actually becoming more transparent with each other in a way, but then also they're getting a huge benefit from that because they actually, you know, will be able to engage in these products more strategically.
Yeah. Hey, Ben. Yeah. I had a question about. So there's more and more open source code nowadays. I think, for example, we're seeing like most of the tools that we use for web development being open source code, like Angular, React. We're seeing the building bricks of artificial intelligence like TensorFlow and being more and more open source, but it's also more and more centralized in the way that Google, Amazon, Facebook are essentially driving the governance of these open source ecosystems. So, and I guess they're using it in a way for soft power and to position themselves as platform in also in the developing ecosystem. So what should be the role of states and city in that case when they develop their own or contribute to open source ecosystems, and what could be the specificities in which they are? And I think we could add a question is because I think there's really different views in America and in Europe, so what would be the European specificity when we try to develop our own internet giants and our own maybe open source projects?
No, this is it's a great question. And I feel like there are a couple of layers to it. I mean, there's in some ways, you know, this idea of, you know, version control and its sort of forkability and the ability to make builds for specific contexts, you know, and the way in which you can have kind of a common core that then is extended is not unlike the European project itself. So in Europe, you know, this is something that, for instance, the European Commission has recognized as something that's a valuable thing to think about and pursue, is this idea of, you know, a collaboratively produced platform, which is essentially what it already represents. But, you know, in some ways, the idea that this would exist in a functional layer of software is also something that's interesting. So, but, you know, in general, the idea that, you know, these are open source packages that do things like maybe operate a library or a K-12 school, and there is no, you know, there is no necessity, because they're open source, that it is downloaded by a public administration. You could be, you know, people off the grid somewhere, you know, having a momentary utopia. Unfortunately, they all seem to be momentary. But you know, that have you know, that they, oh, we're going to download all these tools and operate them ourselves, and it's going to be great, and we'll be off the grid. And that's fine. You know, these are in some ways decentralized, and you can even, you know, work on it. Obviously, you're saying that the manpower of the larger entities that are developing the code obviously directs it, and that's true. I mean, that's true of like most human efforts, is that like and this is why a public option to that problem is useful. The idea that it's not just one set of actors. I mean, the state obviously has its problems as well, but the idea that the diversification of the marshaling of infrastructural kind of capabilities is useful because it allows for people to make these choices and combine in some ways the facets of those services that they need. But you know, it's hard to imagine ways in which you can. I mean, obviously there's some kind of potentially anarcho-syndicalist solution that would allow everyone to sort of generate a network of work that this could, you know, that everyone could participate in. But the way that right now human efforts at scale happen is that they hang off of large organizations. And so we have private large organizations, we have public ones. These are now all working towards providing some of this infrastructure. So the more diversification of those typologies that we have, the more choices one has in where you turn for these kinds of solutions.
This is great. This is great stuff. I was curious about how the foundation sees itself in terms of looking at the economic models for how the software gets built and whether that's part of the code standard and kind of it's building off of the previous question, yeah. Just where you see the role of other types of institutions like nonprofits or in building this infrastructure that's going to have long-term public use and continued development.
Yeah, and community of practice. And that's like, and that I think, you know, hopefully it will be as diverse as possible. I mean, obviously, right now I've talked mostly about, you know, our first round of partners, which are mostly European, but I didn't answer the part of the question that was going to be about the context of, you know, American versus European situatedness. And, you know, all of these actors have totally different ways of being able to engage and constraints politically and socially and economically. But I think the economic model for us is, like I said, either, you know, some public organizations have developed their own technical development capability, technical sort of production capabilities, and those obviously can engage directly with contributing to code bases. But I think the more interesting one, and that was sort of what I was talking about in the support part of it, is developing this ecology that breaks down kind of the idea that coding on huge projects can only happen inside of huge organizations, which is kind of, aside from glaring examples like Linux or Mozilla or Apache, you know, a lot of the big public projects have to have this kind of institutional infrastructure, which we're kind of also hoping to provide for some of these urban scale projects for on the civic scale. And the hope is that, you know, one can take something like DCDM or whatever, you know, some governance tool like we were saying, and arrive at a roadmap, and then that, you know, that roadmap is a political object, but that roadmap then becomes issues that are plugged into a system, and the issues hopefully can be broken down into work packages that are doable by small entities that are engaged with individual municipalities. So a municipality that's a partner in the project can say, oh, hey, let's do this UI revamp that we've all talked about. We're going to commission agency X that we have here locally to help us do that. And so that generates a whole kind of ecosystem of, you know, work and the kind of the way that work is provisioned and a procurement reform in a way that allows for, you know, municipalities to potentially understand how they can engage with open source. Because a lot of times when municipalities are faced with a choice of like, oh, I could go with Oracle, who has like a 5-year SLA, you know, it's so easy, or I could get this, you know, open source package that's developed by a guy in a basement in a country whose language I don't speak, they will probably go, you know, for plan A. But, you know, if you have this kind of way of creating a vehicle in which those, you know, people are, you know, integrated into an entity that, you know, that the city has trust in and has, you know, understands how that can be sort of continuous and how it can be something that they have a direct relationship with is a very different headspace that they can get into. And I think, you know, that the development studios recognize that they can participate in that kind of field effect of like, oh, this project is part of an ecosystem that's trusted, even if we as an individual entity, not known by the city, are, you know, yet to be trusted by them, they can at least benefit from the sort of association with the larger framework and the goals of the framework.
So hi. You just answered my question, so... Pretty amazing presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, is the last one question here? Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. So thank you very much. It is fascinating. A lot of what you were talking and this quality assurance, etc. So I feel like it is very much focused on the code, on the package, marketing for the package. But usually, So we tend to think cities are pretty similar. They have these common needs. But when you think, especially from country to country, the competencies they have, the way public servant works. So there is a lot of institutional things that are built above that actually, if you just look at the quality and documentation of the code, mm-hmm. so somehow you wouldn't really understand how something has been done. So yeah. there is a lot of assumptions there on how it is worked, what problems they are solving, the processes of use.
Yeah.
In the case of the CIDIM, there is also a mentality on what is understood as mm-hmm. participation. So I just wanted to know, how are you thinking about this? If this is something that you think should be part
very much so. I mean, that is actually core to what we're doing. This whole idea that the policy, when I say policy and software are stacked, I mean the representation of the function as something that is legible to actors in the political space or the social space, as well as the technologists. So, you know, the idea that it's documented in a way that everyone can understand what it's doing and how to approach it and what that means is one part of it. And then the other part is sort of the community stewardship angle of that is about creating the mechanism by which this is socialized, by which it is, you know, everyone can understand, you know, there are people that are all the people in the community will hopefully be able to face outward toward the things that they're adjacent to in the next nearby, you know, community, whether that's geographic or practice wise or whatever, and be able to bring those people across and explain to them. And the idea of fostering sort of ambassadors that have the understanding of what the function, what the point, and what the culture and the approach and all these things. You know, a lot of times it's about giving tools within, you know, to a group within a municipal government who already understands the value of this to communicate that value to the rest of their government, because then it allows them to do the procurement reform or do the sort of political process. I mean, it's not meant to be, you know, lobbying per se, but it's the idea that these applications have, you know, are fully explained in a way that is available to whoever approaches them. That's kind of, you know, it's kind of the full stack in that way, in terms of reaching all the way to understanding from a political or social or just citizen perspective.
Okay, thank you very much. Time's up. We're going to have lunch. Thank you.